Welcome, everybody, to the TechMeme Ride Home Experience for Thursday, January 27th. We are joined today by three amazing reporters in this space, people who cover the tech world, startups, investments, and know a lot more than Brian or I do about some of these things, especially, you know, given last week's episode. We are joined by Natasha from TechCrunch. We're joined by Katie Ruth from Bloomberg, and also a special guest, Christine Hall from TechCrunch, has also joined us today. So with that, Brian, I will let you set this up and get us going.
Well, yes. Before I do, Chris, how are you feeling? I know you COVID-ed yourself last weekend.
Friday afternoon or so, I started to feel a little tickle in my throat. And by that evening, it was like full blown, okay, I have something. And I tested the next day and turns out, yes, indeed, Omicron got to me. I was so good for all of the pandemic. And I thought for sure I was going to skate scot-free, but no. And the first 2 days sucked. Actually, what was most interesting to me, being, of course, a tech person, was that my Oura Ring caught it. It knew exactly. My sleep was shit, my readiness was shit, and it basically told me what I already knew. So I've been on the mend, and as of today, my Oura Ring is reporting that I'm in much better health than I was before. So there you go.
Yeah, that screenshot you sent me of the report from your Oura Ring has pretty much convinced me to get one, because I was like, oh, wow, that really does tell you a lot.
I can literally see it. And I will say for those who don't have this ring, which is a wearable, it did a good job of just measuring my overall heart rate and body temperature while I was sleeping. And those two things were both elevated and way outside the norm. And so that was the big clue. So, yeah.
I have an Oura Ring as well. And after I got the vaccine and the booster, it was like, are you okay?
Yes.
So for 2 days, each time it thought I wasn't doing well, but then I recovered. But it was kind of nice for me because it validated, that I
that something was happening, right? Yes.
But I'm sorry to hear you had COVID, but glad you're on the mend.
Thank you. And I will say I was triple vaxxed. So, the vaccines worked, and I'm very, very glad that I had them, and I'm very much alive still. So,
well, good to hear that. I am going to seg right into it.
Go for it.
We just heard from Katie. So I'm going to start with you, Katie. And basically we're going to talk about sort of what we talked about last week, but what has continued to be sort of the big story this last week, which is, in general, the stock market has been up and down, but that's not really the story, because it's sort of been a slow motion bloodbath for about 2 months for sort of the tech companies and sort of the recent IPO vintage companies that we follow on the show all the time. So I specifically in light of that, Katie, do we have any overriding theories for why over the last 2 months, all of the leaders, not just the SaaS companies, but a lot of the SaaS companies, but also the Spotify's, the Pinterest's, you name it, have all of a sudden been basically a lot of them cut in half and things like that. Do we have any overriding theories for why this is happening right now?
Well, I think it's a multitude of factors, but I think one of them, you look at the performance of tech stocks last year, particularly newly public tech stocks. A lot of times the IPOs are where the money is to be made, but last year that was not the case. IPOs, and especially SPACs, most of the SPACs traded down. So you have that kind of effect that, probably spooked some investors who had been the most excited about tech. But you also have broader problems with the stock market, partly due to, this ongoing COVID situation, inflation, other conflicts in the world. There's just a lot happening that, just has people feeling a little bit more negative. And then, of course, there have been concerns with some of the valuations and market caps getting really high relative to revenue. And that has scared some investors as well. So it's a combination of things, but certainly it feels very, very different than, a year ago did.
or even 2 months ago. Natasha, M.G. Siegler wrote a piece, I think it was this weekend, arguing that it's a reversion to the mean, sort of, where it's just like, okay, things got ahead of themselves, so even though this is a very tough pullback, it's not necessarily, because, you know, sometimes when these things happen in the stock market, it's because, oh, one company had really bad earnings or something like that. And I don't feel like that's necessarily happened, but you guys have been writing at TechCrunch a lot about this recently. What's your take in terms of, is this just sort of probably natural and healthy that things are slightly coming back to earth for some of these companies?
Yeah, I read that essay and I liked that he didn't say like the bubble was bursting. I think he used a metaphor that was something like the balloon is slowly deflating, which I think works. Like, I think from what I've heard from investors, we're seeing checks take a little longer to write. Due diligence is changing from maybe a day to 1 week or 2 weeks. And so I think it's kind of in line to believe that we're seeing more of like a correction and like a sane moment in startups finally that I've personally been waiting for than like a really sad moment. Like, it's not going to feel like March 2020 anymore. I think that's probably because there's so much capital in the markets that at least on the private side, I don't think we're going to see startups disappear or have those back-to-back layoffs that really like defined the early innings of the pandemic.
Well, and Christina, Chris and I talked about this a lot last week, but I guess that's sort of the big question is, what does this do to startup valuations, to the VC startup ecosystem? If essentially it was party all the time for the last 18 months in terms of, you know, you could take a SaaS company public, at Decacorn valuations and stuff like that. If now maybe you have to pull back what your expectations are, it's not necessarily the moon. Maybe you just have to expect going to orbit. Are we starting to get a sense from the VC community or from founders that some of the early stage, especially valuations of startups, are sort of coming back to earth as well?
Yeah, I would definitely say that. I just spoke with an investor, I think it was yesterday or the day before, who said the exact same thing, that he was just like, you know, this is something that we're looking at. And I kind of asked that same question. I was like, well, what is that going to look like with, you know, the valuations? Is it going to be bad? Is it going to be that, you know, what's it going to be like for a startup looking for capital? And it's kind of like what Natasha talked about, where it's going to take a little bit more time. And the check sizes, you know, I think there was a race for, you know, over the past 18 months or 2 years, you know, for the VCs to like raise more and more and more because the check sizes were getting larger and they were having to keep up with that. And so now I kind of wonder if they are like this a little bit, where maybe the check sizes don't have to be so big or won't have to be so big, but it'll be okay because it'll all kind of work out together. Like, it won't be such a shock to the system that it kind of slows down.
You know what? I hope we don't forget. I do want to get to, you know, VCs raising gigantic funds and things like that later on. But I'm curious, I feel like, because remember there was even a few months ago some chatter in the VC Twitter sphere and Medium and places like that where folks are like, these valuations are insane. Who's going to be the first one to say the emperor has new clothes? This is for anybody who wants to answer that. Do you think that maybe this is an opportunity that VCs have been waiting for to be like, okay, settle down. you're asking for too much. Your valuation is too, like, do you think this is going to give them an excuse to pull back the reins a little bit, like they've maybe probably been wanting to do for a while now?
Yeah, I actually think that a lot of VCs don't want to write expensive checks. I mean, they want to get in at the lowest price possible. So while from the exit perspective, they benefited from investments they made 10 years ago, you know, now going public and being worth a lot of money, for making new investments, they want to pay the lowest possible price. So a lot of VCs have been complaining about that for a while, that they had to pay so much to get access to the hot deals. So they were actually hoping for, you know, pricing to reset in some respects. But again, you know, they also want their prior investments to do well. So it goes both ways. But yeah, you know, we are starting to see lower prices trickle down. I mean, it starts with the growth stage. A lot of the crossover investors are starting to change their mind on what they think is a fair price for deals. The Information had a good story on some allegations about Tiger Global allegedly changing their mind on some deals. It starts with the growth stage, but it will trickle down to earlier and earlier stages as well.
To what degree, and again, all these questions now are for anybody who wants to take them. To what degree is the SPAC window seemingly closed now, playing a role in this? Because as I said on the show many times, when SPACs were hot about a year ago, it was giving the opportunity for companies to reach public markets that probably were not ready for it and probably could have used another couple years baking. So is that one of the things that's happening right now? Is that sort of that really easy trap door being shut is making people pull back a little bit as well?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that. I talked to Mary D'Onofrio on Equity This Week. She's the co-founder of the growth practice at Bessemer Venture Partners. And she essentially said the IPO window is closed. And we all know it's like kind of hard to avoid talking about the mega funds every answer. But, you know, if you think about being a late stage startup right now, you have so much access to capital. Why go to the public markets and why rush to the public markets even more so? So I think, unfortunately for tech reporters, we're going to have to wait a little longer to see financials than before.
Because we've had a couple of IPOs now pooled. I think there was even one today in the Netherlands or something like that, right? The IPO calendar, which was seemingly every other day for a while, is kind of barren right now, right?
That, and also just like a lot of regulations and the antitrust conversation is popping back up again. I think NVIDIA and ARM fell through this week, which feels like it's a little bit separate, but like I think it's just like another example of like why try and exit right now when it seems like not the friendliest market to do that.
How much is what's going on with just either government regulation, the threat of government regulation around monopolies and antitrust and rolling back mergers and acquisitions and things like that, also affecting the calculus on how these companies, you know, should move forward or how to raise money, et cetera?
So, you know, just on the IPO window, I actually am hearing that there are a bunch of high-profile companies that are going to go public this year. We've reported on Reddit and GoPuff and StockX. So I don't think the IPO window is completely shut, but certainly some that were on the fence are thinking twice. I think it's SPACs that people are getting more concerned about because SPACs, you know, which are technically acquisitions, a lot of them just really haven't traded well, and some people feel like it's not the best format, although there will still be more companies doing a de-SPAC. But in terms of M&A, I think that, yeah, regulation is definitely weighing on the minds of the big tech buyers. You know, any deal they do, they know it could come under scrutiny. So if they think there's a chance that it's going to be, you know, a big, you know, that it might not be completed, then they're less likely to bother going down that path. But as valuations come down and some companies that were on the fence that are less likely to go public, a bird in the hand from, you know, an acquisition offer might be more attractive. I mean, I was thinking back to early last year and I reported on, you know, Clubhouse turning down $4 billion from Twitter and Discord, you know, turning down $12 billion from Microsoft.
Yeah,
Discord
moment.
May end up being worth more when they go public. But, you know, there were a lot of deals that were like, you know, people were turning down big offers. And so I do wonder in this environment if that's going to feel riskier.
Well, and that was going to be my next question. It would be that if you have a lot of these high flyers down, we've already seen, you know, Microsoft snap up Activision because the stock was down. It was down for other reasons, in theory. But you've got things like Robinhood down 68%, Pinterest down 47% from its highs, Peloton down 74%. That's maybe a slightly other story too. But do you think that maybe that'll be the story for the next few months, that there are enough walking wounded right now that there's going to be people that are going to be, I don't know, fishing for M&A right now?
I think that, you know, right now there are going to be companies that, you know, are going to, you know, as I was saying, they're going to be more inclined to take the offer that they have in hand. I mean, certainly if a tech stock trades down and doesn't do well, then they also are more inclined to be overtaken by a buyer. I mean, public companies in particular, they have a fiduciary duty to do what's in the best interest of their shareholders. So if they get a really attractive offer, it becomes hard to turn that down. So that, you know, this trading environment does open up the door to more M&A, because obviously if you were more optimistic in the bull times and you thought that your stock was going to keep going up and up, or your, you know, valuation were going to keep going up and up, then you wouldn't want to just kind of throw in the towel the way some people think about M&A.
Just to add to, like, I think in the ed tech world, especially more in the private markets, a phrase I've heard from startups so often is like, this is offensive capital, not defensive capital. And I don't think they'll ever stop saying that necessarily, but I do think we might see some newer unicorns not use all the capital that they have in their bank from VCs for M&A just yet. We might start to see words like runway start to pop up.
Can you actually unpack those two terms, offensive and defensive capital?
Yeah, I mean, so offensive capital would definitely be more about M&A, like adding companies to your list. I mean, so many companies became platform plays.
So that if you raise a $400 million round, you would have a couple months ago gone out and bought a competitor for $100 million or something like that. Whereas now you might use that to make sure you don't go bankrupt in 18 months.
Got it.
Exactly. Got it. It's kind of like when Brex bought that coffee shop, and that was such a moment in tech. And I think we're not going to see any coffee shops being bought by venture-backed startups in the next year. but I mean, the kind of end point there would be like, I do think we'll see some of them start to think about their money in a more conservation sort of mindset, which I think we're already seeing VCs start to recommend. So that feels
scarcity versus abundance, basically.
Exactly.
Got it. Cool.
I think one thing people have to keep in mind is the reason this is different than the dot-com bubble bursting is because when things are public, you know, there can be an overnight crash. But when things are private, it can take a lot longer, especially because these companies raised, you know, as Natasha was saying, a lot of them have extra money on their balance sheets, and there's money that hasn't been spent. So they, you know, if they may find right now they're talking to investors and they can't get the valuation they want, then they just won't raise a round. And so it's going to take, you know, several years for many of these startups to, you know, really get to the point of desperation where they have to do down rounds or layoffs and all that. I mean, it may come sooner for some, but these companies aren't just going to evaporate if they, you know, unless they're very capital intensive businesses that were really, you know, counting on raising every 6 months or whatever the pace was.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there is no compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on the latest headlines, their family group chat, their crossword puzzles, just because they're available right now or they take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. And you can search by location, availability, and insurance, so literally no compromises here, because with ZocDoc, you've got more options than you know. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. And these docs all have verified reviews from actual real patients. We're talking about booking appointments with tens of thousands of top-rated, patient-reviewed, credible doctors and specialists. I have personally used ZocDoc to find a podiatrist when I needed one for the first time ever in my life. Go to ZocDoc.com/techmeme and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/techmeme. ZocDoc.com/techmeme. With everybody fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. With Constant Contact, you'll reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and communicate more effectively to sell more, raise more, and fast-track growth. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Plus, you can send with confidence knowing your emails are actually reaching your customers thanks to Constant Contact's best-in-class 97% deliverability rate. I use this, and you should too. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee, so get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Can I go ahead and take it to the other side of the coin, which is, you know, all of the money that has been raised by funds, by the investors? Because we're talking about, you know, from the startup side, people have been raising large rounds. So in theory, they've got a lot of money to spend, or they bought themselves a lot of runway. But at the same time, especially in the last year, we've seen just ginormous funds raised, billions and billions of dollars, bigger fund raises than we've seen before in a lot of different sectors. And that money is going to have to be deployed, right? Like, so I'm curious what you're hearing from the VC side, which is, I don't get the sense that they're not, they might not want to write as big a check, but they're not going to stop writing checks anytime soon, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, if you don't invest the money, you don't get any returns, right? So that's part of what was driving up the prices to begin with. There's just so much capital in the ecosystem right now, and it just has to be spent. And so maybe venture firms were saying, oh, this doesn't feel right. I'm paying too much for this deal. But, you know, you know, they have to do something with the money. So that's part of the problem. And so really it comes from the LPs. Until the LPs scale back, which, you know, I did report in a story in Bloomberg this week, we're starting to see a little bit. But until the LPs scale back on a broader scale, we're going to still see a lot of money go into startups.
And we're not getting any sense that that money spigot is going away. You know, you hear things like, well, the reason the stock market is doing what it's doing is because people are expecting interest rates to rise. And so suddenly there are other places for the big pools of money to go and earn returns. Is anybody getting any sense that VCs are worried that they're not going to be able to keep raising these monster rounds?
I think the top VCs are going to continue to be able to raise large funds because, you know, even though past performance isn't technically predictive of future performance, if the top venture funds that have returned, that have made LPs very rich, they usually have no problem getting what they want in any market environment. But I think right now what you're seeing is a lot of smaller funds that kind of sprung up because it was, you know, boom times. And maybe some of those are going to have trouble raising more funds.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like, I think beyond how rolling funds, I think, captured a moment in time where there was so much interest in the emerging fund manager class, I feel like VCs I've spoken to recently are saying that it's now even harder to go from the $10 million fund to the $50 million fund. And so like one idea or conversation I'm having more and more is like, what happens if you don't increase your fund size from fund one, two, and three? And we have a few early stage VCs who do that. And I think they're interesting, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see more VCs taking a, I guess not like a step away, but like maybe a more rational step on what next funds look like. But I mean, the Form D filings are still popping off. So Brian, to your question, I don't think we're going to see anyone stop trying to raise. They just might be a little surprised or a little bit more conservative on those initial targets.
What's anyone's take on the mega raises? You know, Andreessen is basically raising every other day and hiring basically everyone that they can find. We've already got the Tigers and the SoftBanks and stuff like that. But this, do you have a sense that VC is going through generational change like we haven't seen maybe in the last decade or so, where at the top it's getting really, really professionalized, and then, you know, Natasha, you were just talking about the solopreneur solo funds and things like that at the bottom, especially at the top end with these mega funds. Are things becoming more professionalized? I keep using that word. I don't know if it's the right one.
Yeah, I guess like my immediate thought is like, so like the Greylocks and the Andreessens and the Sequoias raising seed funds. Hopefully this answers your question, but this is like my first reaction. Them raising seed funds, I think, helps like a very specific kind of founder succeed and do well, and by do well and succeed, I mean raise money. Like, I think those funds are set up, obviously, mega funds set up to have mega exits. But I think we're still seeing like the pre-seed investing universe, like the Charles Hudsons of the world. They're not raising $200 million seed funds. They're raising, you know, pretty normal, healthy sized funds. And I think that will, I guess, will help the startups that don't fit the profile of like an X Affirm or an X Stripe kind of raise money. So that's kind of my take right now, is like, what is the impact of these bigger funds raising, and are startups going to be more successful? I think a certain kind of startup will have more access to capital, but the ones that don't fit a certain kind of DNA will, you know, have maybe lesser options, but still lucrative options.
We're going to keep going, but I did offer everybody the chance to dip out at a half hour, and it is the half hour now. So if anybody wants to dip out, please take this opportunity, and we'll thank you.
Yes, for coming on. So fun. Thanks for having me, guys. I'd love to be back.
Thank you as well. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you.
Chris, I've got a couple things for you, sort of related to this. I want to get into the idea, we almost got into this last week, but the idea of Web3 as sort of a reason for VCs to have a thesis to invest, for people to get excited. And this is one of those things where I don't have an opinion on either side. I mean, there's people that are cynically talking about, you know, if Web3 hadn't come around, someone would have had to invent it. And the most cynical take is people did invent it. but then, as we've talked about, there's so much energy around Web3 relating to crypto, relating to metaverse and things like that. You would know better than me, being closer to the ground in terms of founders. And you see all the time, there was that joke on Twitter earlier in the week when the stock market was having convulsions, that the inverse of the usual Twitter post where you say, I'm leaving my job to join Web3. The joke was, I'm leaving Web3 to go, you know, work at McDonald's or something like that.
Right. But that was the crypto crash, but yeah.
Right. But so what is your take in terms of, I'm thinking especially of people that are leaving FANGs, that are starting Web3 startups and crypto startups and things like that. Do you feel that this is something that is an organic movement or something that was partially dreamed up by these mega funds that need somewhere to deploy their money.
Oof. I don't like to put too much stock in conspiracy theories because it's hard enough to get ideas and products off the ground that, I mean, conspiracy theories have their own sort of aspects as products that people want and, you know. So I'm not going to go down that path, but one thing that I am curious about and that we didn't really hear much about in terms of our guest today, like, is in a way, like, how people in the crypto Web3 world who are used to volatility in the market, in their portfolios, you know, like the whole kind of meme about like, you know, holding and just riding these waves, whether that has actually created a different psychological profile of people who are building Web3 startups to weather this period and this sort of macro downturn. Like, if it's not actually that strange or that uncomfortable, whereas I think for people who are more used to conventional markets, like, this is like, oh my God, it's like a big sell-off. Like, you know, like the market's like obviously going through like a big post-pandemic correction. So I guess I'm wondering about that on the one hand. Then on the flip side, I guess I also wonder about what I'm seeing in terms of different types of fundraising vehicles, coordination, collaboration, and stuff that is like just novel when it comes to either raising money or raising resources or deploying them. And I'm thinking specifically about, I think like YC just started some sort of DAO or something along those lines. And then you're bringing in actually a lot more analytics and just, you know, hard data crunching and much more sophisticated financial instrumentation where, you know, you can also raise money, for example, on your startup's actual like revenue. And so it's much closer to, I guess, modeling the reality of how much you're actually worth than, you know, before, where it was all kind of smoke and mirrors and just kind of a really good pitch deck. And if you went through YC and you had your, you know, 30-second pitch, you could raise, you know, X millions of dollars.
So there's two things there. First of all, on the one hand, I'm hearing you talk about DAOs and things like that, which, by the way, there's been a couple of interesting DAOs recently that I need to talk about on the show, some pretty big ones or whatever. But the other thing I hear you talking about are things like what Pipe does, where especially if you're a SaaS company and you have annual recurring revenue and things like that, that instead of raising rounds, you can basically sell your revenue sort of like it's a bond. It's sort of like,
Pipe.com raising, is doing this.
Right. It's sort of like raising, a convertible note or whatever, where it's like, all right, we'll front you this money because we believe that these subscriptions and this ARR is going to come in. And then that way, you don't necessarily even have to play in the VC.
I think that's what I'm saying. Like, there are just so many new financial instruments for, you know, pulling in money that in some ways, like VCs or these mega funds dangle just enormous, you know, amount, like vat of cash in front of you and says, here you go, like have this, relative to those other things, which might be actually more prudent, but are just less sexy because there's not enough zeros behind them. So I'm just wondering what the dynamics are at work here, where either, you know, some startup founders might be savvy and be like, well, when the money's easy to get the money. Whereas for other, like, less experienced folks or folks who are actually working in the crypto space are so much closer to financialization that their level of either savvy or sophistication might be higher than your conventional sort of Web2 startup that really, well, and, you know, I'll speak for myself. I was not, you know, a person in the money world. Like, I didn't think about money. Money wasn't relevant to me. It was all about growth. It was all about adoption. It was just about getting people to use technology for the very first time. And we're beyond that. You know, people grow up with cell phones now. You don't have to convince them to like download an app. They know what it is. They, you know, some people have a password manager. Like, you know, they're used to a number of the behaviors that were huge barriers to adoption for previous eras of technology. So in some ways, I think startups starting now get to start so much further down the road and get closer to actually running a business than, you know, when we were just futzing around before and trying to establish like, oh, like, you know, what is a like button or something, you know, when the primitives just weren't as obvious and as, I don't know, I guess like widely sort of understood, right? So it feels like the things that are going to get funded to go big have to have some sort of traction, have to have some sort of like demonstrable business model where they actually have customers, especially in like the SaaS space, or at least you'd hope so. So I'm trying to just think about or, you know, discount those things, or I'd rather include those things into how we're thinking about what's going on in the markets.
Can I, I'm going to admit my,
please do, this is lack of safe space.
Lack of knowledge I need to educate myself more in terms of DAOs, but isn't one of the promises of a DAO the idea, and this is basically, this is the bread and butter of the Web3 idea, mm-hmm. which is that you can raise money from a community of users. Uh-huh. And so that in a sense, if you had a product of any kind, but even if it was a SaaS or a software product of some kind, something that we'd charge a subscription for, that you could go, it's sort of not putting the cart before the horse, but when you're talking about like you can be so much further down the road, is part of the promise of DAOs that idea that if you have a community, if you have people really enthused about your project, you can just raise the money from the people that are also potentially your end users and customers.
Let me separate some things in terms of how at least I'm thinking about this. And it's a good question, and it's easy to see how a lot of these, well, acronyms and jargon can quickly kind of, you know, run away from you in terms of what they actually mean and what they, where the state of the technology and behavior actually is. So I think in some ways what you're talking about might be raising either a community round or something like a party round. This could be, you know, previously a party round was actually kind of like a pejorative thing. Like you couldn't find one VC to lead your round and to get all the other people to sort of like go in line and close the deal and make it happen. So you'd have a party round, you would ask a bunch of people and they'd put in small checks. And it was super annoying because you'd have this exploding cap table, which meant that every subsequent round that you wanted to raise, you needed to go back to each of those investors, you know, who honestly have very little skin in the game, and get them to agree to whatever happens next. Now, ironically, that's actually kind of what a DAO sort of is built upon, the idea that people have a bunch of tokens in your startup, whatever it is that you've, you know, minted as tokens or NFTs, and they can, you know, stake those, that collateral, more or less, on the decisions that you make as
an organization. You're voting. You have a say.
That's right.
Okay.
So, but I mean, it's similar, like if you are on the cap table of someone and you have a very small, you know, percentage or whatever, but everybody on the cap table has a very small percentage of the company, then everybody has kind of votes that need to go along with subsequent funding rounds and possible dilution and things like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'm trying to get at is that
in theory, a DAO structure is supposed to be on-chain, in that the decisions that are sort of made by the organism, the organization, whatever you want to think about it, is more transparent. It's able to be scrutinized by, you know, outside people, and things are put to a vote. And you can write the rules such that, you know, maybe it requires like 2/3 majority or something like that. So not everybody has to agree, but it's some sort of almost like parliamentary system for moving forward based on the people that actually have an interest in what it is that you're doing. And those could be your customers. They could be your investors. They could be just random people that hold crypto and, you know, wanted to go along for the ride, things like that.
Right, because you wouldn't even have to be there at the beginning if you bought a whole bunch of coins in some project.
Right, I mean, that's the other thing too, right? Yeah. Like, and again, like I want to be very careful because there's the regulations are very unclear and they don't really exist yet. But in some cases, you know, you can have people come in later, buy the coins or NFTs from the early backers of projects and sort of, you know, gather your stakes and then end up with more voting rights, like over time. And that doesn't necessarily have to go through some, you know, reconfiguration of your SACE or whatever it is that your funding documents might be. So it creates a little bit more flexibility and a bit more dynamism actually, in terms of how these startups can move and who they can bring in as, you know, investors and so on and so forth.
I'm going to shift
your question, by the way.
Yeah, it does, because, like I said, I still need to do more research. One quick thing on that. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of the ancient history of ICOs and things like that.
Yep.
Of what, 4 or 5 years ago?
Yep.
That idea of governance was not involved in that early ICO period. You were just...
I Well, we didn't really have the concept of like the DAO, you know, as an organizing concept and as something that you could sort of demand or ask for. So I think there was this implicit idea that when you were part of a initial coin offering, that you would, these would be your stake in the organization of the company. And if you were there for an airdrop of coins, then, you know, you could, well, people would speculate on them and your, you know, share of value might go up because, you know, ideally there was some pool of liquidity behind that, whether it was a startup or, a VC or someone else putting in money into the company itself. But I think where that kind of went wrong was that a lot of people wrote a lot of white papers, but not a lot of code. And so trying to do what they said that they were going to do really wasn't that feasible. And, you know, the work may or may not have happened. I think there were a lot more rug pulls back then because it was just a wild time and people were still getting their heads around how this stuff works, how it should work. And a lot of the capabilities, I think, that the DAOs now are relying on may not have been immature. Certainly the tools were not as mature as they're becoming.
Like I said, I want to move slightly to the side from that to talk about NFTs. I just sent you a link to a Twitter thread, which you can
I will pin to the room. Yeah,
and I'm going to really try hard to remember to put this in the show notes when we publish this. But this is also a bit of housekeeping that I've been meaning to get to that you can help me with, which is, I think we talked about it on the show. I know I mentioned it a little bit that I got a lot of crap from listeners when I was unaware that gamers were against NFTs a month or 6 weeks ago, whenever it was, when I first did a story about that. Obviously now I've seen, you know, tons of examples.
It's mind-blowing. I think I've even it really is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, what I was accused of is, you know, which I'll cop to, oh, you're in a bubble. How do you not know that people hate the idea of crypto and hate the idea of NFTs? Okay, fine. You know, look.
If you're not in a bubble, you're probably not actually consuming any news. So we're all in a
bubble. But again, right. And one of the things that I try hard to do is to try to be a straight shooter to everybody. So, like, people, and it's continued where people are like, enough with the NFT stuff, enough with the crypto stuff, except for the fact that I'm trying to do a show about technology, and that's been a lot of the news lately,
yeah,
right?
So, totally.
But okay, so I'm not pro NFT crypto, I'm not anti NFT crypto, but I will cop to being taken aback by the vitriol and people's antipathy. Did I say that right? Yeah. To some of the stuff, and I saw a thread over the weekend that I'm going to read the first four tweets from, because it's the first one that I was like, oh, okay. I see where you're coming from on this. This is from a Twitter user called EVEEVEE. I believe he's a, he or she, oh, she is a game developer. An artist, hacker, etc. So she says that, like I said, I'm going to read the first four tweets verbatim here. NFT people absolutely cannot comprehend where I'm coming from. Fundamentally do not understand that the very phrase digital asset fills me with revulsion. I do not want this on a very basic level. I do not want what you are selling. I do not want it to exist. I think the internet has too much ownership as it is. I don't want it carved up into a billion cubes, each engraved with a serial number and locked into someone's account. Because ownership is a fake idea, we invented it because there's only one of a thing, someone has it and it's theirs. But then we invented computers and digital abundance. And now so much stuff is just there. You can go make your own copy and now you have it too. This is true freedom, the dream of the web. Everything is bountiful, everything is for everyone. You want to carve it up and add locks and permissions and sales and transfers because in your wildest dreams, you cannot even imagine a world not designed like a trading card game. So that spoke to me a bit because, you know, I'm of the generation of, you know, the web was this freedom and the web was sticking it to the man by being against this idea of ownership. Right.
I remember.
Yes. And I feel like you also are someone that has believed in that, too. And I'm not asking you to answer or, you know, argue the NFT case or something like that. But like I said, that really spoke to me. It's like, oh, yeah, I have believed in that too, that one of the good things about the internet revolution was the abundance. Yeah. And the whole premise of some of this Web3 stuff is explicitly to pull back that abundance, right?
Yep. Yep.
So what are your thoughts on that in terms of why it makes sense to me from that perspective that it, I can see why people feel like this is a betrayal of something that is good of the dream of the internet.
You know, I wonder if part of the reason why this is like a hard conversation is just because of the relative experience that I guess people who benefit from the internet use the internet in different ways. Let me try to explain what that means. Like if you're a gamer, of course there are like free to play games and then you see ads that pop up, you know, every so often, and maybe you're rich enough to like, you know, turn off the in-app ads. But if you were someone who never pays for anything, I suppose then all that abundance is great. And certainly, you know, the abundance that we had back in 2005 to 2010, like mostly was really great. You know, there weren't that many ads. Page load speeds were, you know, was something that you really wanted to optimize, and bandwidth wasn't as freely available. So although there were loads of text ads and things like that, in fact, Google's business was built around text ads because they were so much faster to download. Eventually, like free and all that abundance meant that advertisers could just blow up the entire experience for everybody. I mean, like the other day I went to, I'm just going to say it, entrepreneur.com, and I turned off my content blocker, and I swear to God, I could not find the content. I was on an article page. I'm quite sure. I looked at the URL. It was an article, and I could not only tell the difference between what was content and what was an ad, but I literally couldn't discern what was paid for content versus content that theoretically some human had written that was supposed to be educational or useful. You know, and Entrepreneur used to be not like a not terrible magazine, you know, with content. So we now fast forward to a world where, you know, if you're rich or you know enough or you can install Chrome extensions or browser extensions, you can turn off that tax on poor people and your experience isn't that bad. But I think what this person is alluding to or sort of like is missing is how bad that's gotten relative to perhaps the experience of being inside of a game. Or whether it's a 3D environment or something else where the economics and the mechanics of gameplay kind of take place at a different level, like either through, you know, DLC or in-app unlockables or, you know, paying for the game outright, right? The idea of subscribing to access a website or a web magazine or things like that is still pretty uncomfortable, and the vast majority of people don't want to do it. So that feels like something that's very different, where we have these pressures that are coming together, where the economics of funding the web are somewhat antithetical to building, you know, fun and interesting games. But then on the flip side, you know, well, I guess I'm not sure how the art world factors in here, but that abundance that essentially left artists to not be compensated for their work in the Web 2 model suddenly found a way to be compensated because you could bring scarcity back to something that became infinitely copyable and therefore, you know, valueless.
Right. By the way, I do want to, if anyone wants to, this is the time when if anyone wants to raise their hands,
yes. If you'd like to come up and dispute anything, feel free.
But see, but what you just said is exactly sort of what struck with me, because one of the key things of Web 2 was the Napster era, was the LimeWire era.
But think about what we were fighting against, right? Like we were fighting against, you know, $12 to $16 to $18 CDs that you, once you got a computer with like a CD burner, you could actually rip those as MP3s and you could trade them with your friends for free. And so there was this sort of
abundance. But
yes,
artists got hurt by that.
I think it's confusing. It's confusing in some ways because I remember that I was on the opposite side of Metallica. And so I find it very difficult now to be on the side of Lars Ulrich saying, you know, that Napster should be shut down and these guys are pirates and thieves, like stealing our music. I have some sympathy now, but it feels like the middlemen, you know, specifically, you know, men in the middle, were, you know, who were the labels, while at some point, maybe in the 60s and 70s, and I was watching the David Geffen documentary on Netflix, like, we're adding value by doing the curation. Increasingly, they were just taking rents, you know, and we talk about rents a lot. So the cost of the music went up. The amount of money that the artists themselves were getting directly didn't seem to be going up all that much. And so we as fans were like, well, fuck it. Like, you know, you guys make enough money. You're millionaires. Like, we're poor students. We can't afford this. Some of us couldn't. And so we're just going to, you know, figure this out for ourselves because we're ahead of the curve. And I don't know. It's privilege feeding itself, I suppose. Anyways, I brought up Randy because Randy, I think, has a hopefully, well, I expect she does, has a different perspective or a generational perspective on some of the things that we're talking about. And so, Randy, if you want to give us, you know, feel free to introduce yourself. Would love to get your perspective on some of this, the stuff around ownership and yeah.
When you go through airport security, there's one line where the TSA agent checks your ID and another line where a machine scans your bag. The same thing happens in enterprise security, but instead of passengers and luggage, it's end users and their devices. These days, most companies are pretty good at the first part of the equation where they check user identity. But user devices can roll right through authentication without getting inspected at all. In fact, 47% of companies allow unmanaged, untrusted devices to access their data. That means an employee can log in from a laptop that has its firewall turned off and hasn't been updated in 6 months. Or worse, that laptop might belong to a bad actor using employee credentials. Collide finally solves the device trust problem. Collide ensures that no device can log into your Okta-protected apps unless it passes your security checks. Plus, you can use Collide on devices without MDM, like your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. Visit collide.com/ride to watch a demo and see how it all works. That's KOLIDE.com/ride, collide.com/ride. I'm going to a big AI startup demo day here in the city tomorrow, and I will 100% be decked out in Mack Weldon clothing. Why? Well, Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. That's their AirKnit underwear. Crazy, comfortable, but elevated sweatpants, the Ace Collection. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads, the Silver Peak Polo. That's my personal fave. And ultra-soft antimicrobial tees for when you need to stay fresh longer. Their silver crewneck t-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code RIDE. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code RIDE.
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, everyone. This is Randy. I am a designer and I'm building UCast. I'm also a podcaster. But Chris and I have had multiple conversations about decentralization and how Gen Z is very pro-decentralization. And that's why the Web3 movement is something that we all immediately adopted, almost without a second thought. And in my opinion, from my perspective as someone who's not only 22, but basically does not own any assets, there's power in ownership, where before I can never imagine, you know, creating content and owning it myself. It was always towards, you know, different conglomerates where they own my content, they decide my fate, they decide how much it's worth, they decide its value. And then there's a certain kind of empowerment where not just, again, as a 22-year-old to have student debt, but also as someone who comes from an immigrant family where none of my family owns assets. Something as simple as like my PFP of Alpha Girl, I know it doesn't mean a lot, but that piece of ownership and the fact that, you know, that is mine, that gives me some sort of value and that gives me some sort of hope for, you know, ownership does not necessarily have to be a, you know, $3 million home in Toronto that we cannot afford, but it can be simple, small assets here and there on the internet that we can you know, potentially build up as generational wealth, or at least that's like the, you know, the hope or the dream. And that's the value for, I feel like, people like myself.
Let me stress again that I'm bringing up Evie's thread not because, oh, it won me over and now I'm against Web3, because I agree with that. Like, look, you know, the whole idea that if it's free, then you're the customer, that you know, the big platforms, we don't own anything. We're being sold by the big platforms, right? And Chris is using examples of, you know, the advertising model, which Web3 proponents are saying, you know, we're going to fix the fact that you know, advertising, which I've made the point. I made that point in my book that the fact that most of the web to this day is all advertising, when you stop and think about that, oh, it's completely transformed our lives, but it's all just in aid of the attention economy and stuff like that. It kind of blows your mind that we've gotten this far and it's all just based on stupid ads and stuff like that. Okay, the point I wanted to make is, why does it seem like that people that are the most committed to Web3 are like, burn it all fucking down, and everything is terrible and we're going to right all these wrongs? Why does it feel so absolutist? And I think, you know, this is some of the discourse that's been going on online about Web3. I agree that Web3 has good ideas that I hope get adopted and things like that. But do we have to burn everything down to do that? Like, can't we take a little from Web 2 and Web 1 and Web 3 and put it all together?
I have thoughts. I was talking to my friend, my good friend Scott Gavitin, the other night, and we were actually, there's this great 2.5 hour video about called The Problem with NFTs, and I was watching this, I think, on Saturday when, like, my COVID was, like, you know, in full blown, and I was definitely, like, on another planet. And also watching it at 2x. So you can only imagine, like, how this thing sort of freight trained my brain. But nonetheless, I don't know if I recommend that form of ingestion of this content. But, you know, like, in some ways, you have to have that level of arrogance and of self-assurance and of ignorance about the things that have come before you, because once you start to slow down and take into consideration all the ways in which these ideas have previously been tried, and these other ideas that, you know, tried it and it didn't work, and so therefore your thing's not going to work, or, you know, if you think about this community or that community, like, how do you make this all come together? And I don't want to say waters down, but it becomes infinitely more complex. And I certainly found, you know, when I was working on a lot of these standards back in the day that are now broad industry adopted standards, like OAuth, part of the problem of what, like, my job, not being a developer or engineer in those communities, was just to keep bringing us back to the core thing that we were trying to solve and be like, that's out of scope. Like, we're not trying to solve that. Like, this is what we need to focus on. This is what we're doing. And you had to kind of really put on blinders to, I don't know, solve problems at the level that we were trying to solve them. Now, were we right? Were we wrong? Like, I don't know. We were very myopic. I think many of us who worked on these things weren't aware of our own privilege. We were in our own filter bubble, you know. Specifically, Scott and I worked on digital identity. And as two white guys, like, we were not building in protections for a lot of people that would ultimately end up using these platforms or systems, because it was just trying to get them to work. So it feels like we're in a similar era where you have this people with an enormous amount of, you know, privilege and access being like, we can see how to solve and fix the world, because they're above so many of the sort of endemic challenges that a lot of other cultures and communities face. So to answer your question, like, why are they so like, let's burn it all down and start over? Mm-hmm. I think it sort of comes from an urge of being like, well, the people that came before must not have been that smart because they didn't solve these things in these ways. But really, it just means that they're going to end up experiencing the exact same problems that we ran into, but sort of in a new, you know, revolution of the technology. And so a number of factors in the environment will have changed that maybe actually means that it'll actually work that time. But if you do take that kind of conciliatory approach, it's really, really hard to make progress, and people lose interest and they move on before you even have a chance to, you know, kind of make your case. So you see that dynamic, that tension?
Yeah. I want to come at this a different way. Randy, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. Let me, and please, please, please understand. I'm not asking you to answer for this or whatever, but okay. Okay. There's another meme going around where it's a picture where it's like, this is web 1.0 and it's like login and password. This is web 2.0 and it's login with either Google or Facebook or Twitter or whatever, right? And then web 3 is connect your wallet. So Randy, I completely understand this idea of owning something, of controlling your own destiny. I'm with you. That's incredibly powerful. But when someone like EV is complaining that everything in Web3 seems to be transactional, like that's the joke of saying connect your wallet is Web3. Can you understand where people are coming from?
Are you asking about the value systems?
I'm saying the idea that everything is connected to, it's transactional. Whereas, you know, part of what I think EV is, and this is what you were saying, Chris, where the abundance was free and that's a level of privilege or whatever. But in the same way that gamers are like, listen, I just want to play my game. I don't want to have to pay for this and that thing and the other thing.
They have a great boss, and, right? Like they don't need or want the changes. They've been well served by the economy as it is. And I think the challenge is that there are a lot of people who are seeing, you know, blockchain technologies, NFTs, changing some of those dynamics and those power dynamics and giving a new generation the opportunity to build, as opposed to sort of like asking permission from a stodgy bunch of old, you know, people now,
right?
You know, who built the Web 2 stuff. And they're like, that's not going to work.
Right. Go ahead, Randy. We
yes,
cut you off.
Yeah. So I think Brian, you have a very good point, which it's a conversation I've had today with a bunch of people about what integration of Web 2 and Web 3 could look like together, right? Because essentially, I don't want, and there's the whole Calendly joke going around today and last 2 days, and I don't want a Web3 Calendly, right? I don't want to change all my products from Web3.
On-chain availability.
Right. The joke for that is that, yes, to get on my calendar, you're going to have to pay gas fees, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so I don't want everything to change from Web2 to Web3, and I don't think anybody wants to see that because, you know, it's inefficient to just leave all the Web2 products that have essentially amazing functionality and say, okay, connect your wallet to access everything. But then there is the way I see it is Web2 gave us access to a lot of resources and information and gave us access to, like you said, a lot of abundance, right? But unfortunately, not everybody had access to, I would say, good information and good resources, and did not have access to good communities and did not have access to, good assets from Web2.
Can you say a little bit more about that? Why was that, and where, like, how were things segregated, perhaps?
It was simply just people did not know where to find good information, right? And then there's, you know, propaganda, there's media, there's, you know, for example, I'll tell you the simplest thing is that the information that I was exposed to in the Middle East as a woman was vastly different than the information I was exposed to as a woman here in Canada. Right. And before coming to Canada, I didn't have any resources available to me. We had very strong censorship. I didn't have access to a lot of things on the internet, whether it's developer tools, whether it's designer tools, whatever it was. Right. And so coming here, I had suddenly an abundance of information that I didn't even know where to begin to explore and what to do with it. And that was overwhelming. That was confusing. And not all the information I was exploring was good information or good resources or good assets that I was buying, right? And so I feel like Web2 gave us access to that abundance, but abundance does not necessarily bring value, in my opinion. Abundance just feels overwhelming sometimes. So what Web3, I feel like, provided me with is the ability to seek value and the ability to understand where value is on the internet and buy into that, right? So it's not just taking everything on the internet and try to flip it for a profit, but it's actually understanding where people are finding values, whether it's in community, whether it's in utility, whether it's in a digital art, whether it's in a game, you know. And yes, sometimes, you know, it's bullshit how communities are blowing up and have virality and all of that.
But well, or that a lot of communities are they're exclusive by nature. That's part of the thing of certain communities where it's like, okay, if you buy into this cool club, mm-hmm. then you're behind the velvet rope, right?
But I think, sorry,
exclusive by nature. But also everybody had the chance for that exclusivity. It's not like it excluded based on financial ability, based on race, based on color, based on information access. Everybody had the leveled opportunity to go into it. And it was like, okay, whoever put in most effort, you know, got it. And to me, that just gives a playing field, you know, a leveled playing field, if that makes sense.
You're talking specifically about like minting NFTs with different communities and participation in the Discords and things like that. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. So Brian, I think the idea that I think is being brought up here is that hold I can't even say the word, whether it's holding or hodling, different, I guess, digital assets, let's say NFTs, and deploying some of your capital is actually an attention allocation strategy. Mm-hmm. So in the previous era, you know, your attention was being assaulted constantly and you had no interest in the sources of those assaults. Now, by buying or obtaining these assets and, you know, not really thinking about speculation, but actually creating value in an like sort of a localized economy, your interests actually are aligned with holding that asset for as long as possible and creating as much sort of community of value around it. And the fact that you have that token and you can hold it and that it's yours and it can't be taken away from you because it's literally registered in an immutable ledger means that now you have something to sort of show or prove that, you know, you've been around, and that thing actually, which, you know, gets you access into this community where there is value, is something that you could then sell or trade at a later point once you decide you want to move on or otherwise, mm-hmm. right?
Right. The interoperability, I think, is one of the best ideas, like baking that in.
Right. I mean, because we've been talking about that for years. You know, one of the things that I've been thinking about is like the fact that, you know, Facebook has been ostensibly working on like data portability. And I suppose there is some way to sync your, you know, Facebook photos to Google Drive or whatever. Hasn't made any difference in the world meaningfully whatsoever in people's ability to choose which social platforms they want to be on. Because the underlying data itself has nothing to do with where the people are or where the people network or where they expect to find each other. Like, we'll just like move off or move on to other places. The idea that I would, you know, import 20 years of photos mm-hmm. onto the blockchain to like, you know, set up my new profile is laughable because that isn't the way that people, I think, you know, relate to their digital media. It isn't that you don't want copies or backups for yourself, but I think data portability in some ways like misses the point. And where interoperability,
it's more powerful. It's more blowing up. It's, mm-hmm. it's blowing up the competitive moat that all of these platforms have been built on, which is sort of platform lock-in, right? Which again,
well, the exclusivity of the underlying data assets, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Now that data is actually available on sort of a public database, and anybody who has your address can look up what you have and then represent it to you in a way that, you know, is hopefully compelling or interesting or useful.
Well, again, I'm saying I'm preaching to the choir because this is something that you've spent your whole career working on.
Sure.
When you're participating in these projects and communities, to what degree are you fearful of history repeating itself? Because again, look, we were there, man. Blogs were a wild west. We were sticking it to the man, all that stuff, like, you know, sharing your photos on Flickr and stuff like that.
Were we really?
Okay, but hold on. That was the idealism.
Yeah.
That is the same idealism in these ideas. And all that happened is, listen, you can make the argument that what Facebook did was take all of the good ideas of Web 2 and just put them under a big blue umbrella. And sort of obviously commoditize them and make them easier for normies to do blogging and posting and sharing your photos and things like that, but also platform them. So to what degree, when you're participating in these communities and these projects, are you feeling deja vu? Are you fearful, like, oh no, guys, we can't have history repeat itself again, and we're just going to end up a decade from now with new platforms, new bus, same as the old bus kind of thing?
Yeah, well, obviously, in some respects, I'm like, you know, we've had all these conversations and nobody goes and reads the, you know, mailing list archives where we actually talked about all these things, talked about all the threat models. You know, we were there, you know, we went through a lot of this stuff already. It is the way it is for a reason. And what I find is, I don't know, just part of the process is you kind of sometimes have to go through the reinvention process to arrive at the same place that other people have already gotten to who came before you in order to understand how they balanced all of the restrictions, you know, and considerations and concerns to arrive at what could be an elegant outcome, you know, like, and I think about this a lot, you know, obviously given the hashtag, like the hashtag is an invention of its time, a time where the iPhone had just come out. It was literally 8 months old. So the iPhone was not the behemoth that it is now. If it were now, like the hashtag would not have worked. It would not take off. But because of the limitations of bandwidth, because of the maturity or immaturity of the network, because of Twitter being mostly an SMS-based service, there was a window where combining all those limitations forced that one kind of Gemini of an idea to sort of come out. Going back, people would be like, oh, it would be way better if it did this or it did this, but you'd miss the considerations that were part of the calculus that landed with that outcome. So I think in a similar way, like in a different kind of abundance, people now in sort of like the Web3 crypto space don't have to make a lot of the same trade-offs. You know, the fact that you can just assume that a lot of people have internet connectivity, that a lot of people have, I don't know, Chrome extensions, and they know how to operate them. The fact that, you know, bandwidth is much better than it was before. Like one of the stories that you had recently was about whether or not we even have the compute power to run the metaverse the way that it's been articulated.
Right.
And yet we sort of assume that in 5 to 10 years, these problems will be solved. We'll have 5 or 6G technology. You know, we'll have amazing battery power. You know, we'll be switched off of coal and onto nuclear energy or something, or renewables. So there's this kind of tacit assumption that, you know, some things can be kicked down the road, but that we will solve problems for ourselves today that are the most interesting and the most perhaps generative. So am I worried about us, you know, being in the state where we're repeating a lot of the same mistakes as before, and we're just going to have a, you know, a new guard replace the old guard? That's kind of just how human societies sort of fall over time. The question is, can you bring up, you know, sort of very important, valuable cultural considerations such that you can change the nature of how people include one another or treat one another as they're building these systems? And I think that is the most positive sign that I see in a lot of the, at least the NFT Web3 world. There's plenty of crypto bros and there's plenty of assholes and grifters. And I just take for granted that some percentage of all of this is going to go to shit. But there is, and I think, you know, Randy is an example of this, there's a lot more, or at least what seems to be, support and inclusivity and concern for mental health and things like that in these communities that just weren't there in our era of building this stuff.
Hey, Randy, are you still able to talk? I don't mean to keep you on. Yeah. Because I had an idea. I pulled up your profile, and, you know, you're saying that you're exploring podcasting in Web3. So obviously, look, this is my bailiwick, podcasting. So, like, tell me some of the things that the ideas in podcasting that excite you in a Web3 way. Like, what can Web3 do, even if you don't have a specific project, but like, what are the broad strokes of like what we could do if we blew up podcasting as it exists and remake it in a Web3 way?
Yeah. So some of the ideas that we've been exploring, well, the first one was, how can we transition podcasts out of the RSS feed? I think that's the question of the century for us. We hate the RSS feed. A lot of podcasters hate the RSS feed. It's outdated. It's not providing enough analytics. It's not providing, in our opinion, enough distribution to
any new development that's happening in, you know, whether it's, you know, Web3 or crypto or metaverses. And so the first question is, how can we transition podcasts from an RSS feed onto the blockchain or onto a DNS, something like that represents like a registry almost for podcasts, where you're able to track, first of all, analytics a lot more accurately. You're able to track purchasing power behavior based on, you know, let's say you release a hosted ad on your podcast and you want to see the purchasing power of your audience based on their wallet. That's something that you can easily collect, right? And you're able to understand what potential cost of customer acquisition for your podcast could look like. And now suddenly you have some kind of negotiating power for your podcast. And it's not just, hey, I have this many listeners or this many downloads per month. And suddenly you have distribution across, you know, potential games, potential, you know, metaverses, potential NFT communities. There's so much integration that can happen. And a lot of schools of thoughts are saying that audio is going to be the main form of content in Web3. You know, blogging was Web1, photos and videos was Web2, and audio is going to be Web3. So how can we transition audio from Web2 to Web3, and how can we disperse that content across different platforms?
All right, this is the last time I'm going to play devil's advocate, because as a podcaster, that sounds great to me. I make my living from podcasting, so better analytics, better accountability, monetization, and things like that. But to bring it back to EV's thread, what would you say to someone who is like, well, the reason I liked podcasting is as a consumer of podcasts, it's somewhere I can go where I'm not being tracked, where I know there are ads on it. And like, that gets back to what Chris and I were talking about in terms of like the ads being everywhere and ads as a business model and things like that. But what would you say to someone that is like, I like the fact that I can hide as a consumer in podcasting, and I don't want the monetization that maybe Brian as a podcaster would want.
And that's fair, but are you really hiding when you have like major conglomerates like Spotify and Apple tracking you? I mean, it's you're going to get tracked, right? But it's either one or the other. So I guess at least for me, it's which one do you prefer to be tracked by? Do you prefer to be tracked silently by big conglomerates, or do you prefer to be tracked openly and transparently, I guess?
Whenever I need to do financial research for this show, for instance, during tech earnings season, when I have to analyze how various companies' stocks have been performing, I only ever turn to our sponsor today, Yahoo Finance. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They are the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insights to look at your wealth in its entirety. With a community of over 90 million users each month, their real strength is helping you on your way to financial success. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com. How do you make a password that's strong enough so no one will guess it, and it's impossible for you to forget, and do it for 100 different sites, and make it so everyone in your company can do the same without ever needing to reset them? Sounds impossible unless you have 1Password. More than any other product I've ever told you about, I can vouch 1,000% for 1Password. I can't live without it. 1Password makes strong security easy for your people and gives you the visibility you need to take action when you need to. Any device, anytime, 1Password lets you securely switch between iPhone, Android, Mac, and PC with convenient features like autofill for quick sign-ins. All you have to remember is the one strong account password that protects everything else: your logins, your credit cards, secure notes, or the office Wi-Fi password. Passwords award-winning password manager is trusted by millions of users and over 100,000 businesses, from IBM to Slack. It beat out 40 other options to become Wirecutter's top pick for password managers. Right now, my listeners get a free 2-week trial at onepassword.com/ride for your growing business. That's 2 free weeks at onepassword.com/ride. Don't let security slow your business down. Go to onepassword.com/ride.
See, like, I think this is the thing that's so different and so interesting. It's like putting something on the blockchain is, you're like, well, fuck it. I'm already out there anyways. Like, I actually had this attitude. Where did I call it? It was back in the day, you know, we had this idea that we wanted a certain type of privacy, to be anonymous or pseudonymous, or to have some delineation between our offline lives and our online lives. And I think a generation, you know, now grows up, one, with the assumption of being tracked always, just as a matter of practicality, and we may not like it, but that's kind of what's happening. And then two, to take almost like as an act of defiance, the idea of actually just putting even more out there and being more explicit with what you put on the network or you put on the blockchain that represents you, that you make it even more accessible. And so you're like, fuck it. Like, if you want to track me, then here are the things that I want you to know about me. And I'll just make the things that are more like private, like quieter. Maybe you'll still detect them or something, but like, I'm not going to broadcast them. They're not going to be in my wallet, my public wallet, and so forth. So
but
that's a very different approach.
Technically anonymous. Even tracking is technically anonymous, because I can have a wallet that is very completely anonymized and you can track it, but you have no idea that it's traced back to me, right?
Right. So it may not be doxxed.
Yeah, but it's still not traceable back to me as a person. Versus if you're listening or using really, you know, any form of data on Web2, it is traceable back to me as a person, right? As Rand, to my IP, to my information. And that's also another beauty of Web3, is my information can be tracked, but 100% anonymized, right?
Well, or you have a greater level of control over it, right? Mm-hmm. Well, and listen, that's the sort of punk ethos that I do love about Web3, which it is, it's almost like reclaiming words, words of oppression, you know, and claiming them to use them for yourselves. Like that spirit, I completely buy into as well. I don't know. It does become one of those things where, like, you know, like Chris, you and I have been talking about, like, you know, how everything becomes like causes and people. Like, Randy is very passionate and very idealistic from her perspective about Web3, and EV is completely passionate and completely idealistic from the exact opposite side. And it's like, you know, it's not that it's frustrating. It's just that it's like that's. It's fascinating to me that we live in a time where that's everything. There's literally nothing that can happen where it's not just that people have different opinions about it. It's that people have opinions that are so strongly held on either side of it, you know, which is what I was saying when I'm talking about how Web3 people, why do you have to burn it all down? Can't we take a little good from this and a little good from that and stuff like that? But, you know, I don't know.
I still have the cynical view of Web3, though. I still understand that there's a lot that can go wrong, and I understand that Web3 and having public wallets can create a bigger wealth disparity than we already have. And even with what's happening right now, because we're so involved in it on Twitter and on these spaces, we forget that there's more than 95% of the world that still does not know about Web3, that still don't understand what NFTs are, right? That never heard of digital assets or cannot wrap their brain around the concept of blockchain. And that can create not only an information disparity, but also a very big wealth gap. And that is something that I'm very well, and that's the only thing, I guess, that I'm, not the only thing, but one of the few things that I'm cynical about, like extremely cynical about when it comes to Web3. Because I look, again, I look at my cousins in Syria, and they have no idea what this stuff is, right? And they probably never will interact with it, not at least for a couple of years. And that now already puts them at a very large disadvantage, right? So those are like some examples that also scare me in terms of how fast we are
growing this technology?
I'm on the one hand, I'm like, that's a really big thought to like end this on. And on the other hand, it's a really big thought to end this on, because like in some ways, some of the ethos that's going into Web3 and like, again, like I think why I love like hearing from Randy and why Randy's perspective is so valuable here is, you know, she brings a perspective like as an immigrant, as a person in tech, you know, as a woman, as, you know, a Canadian, as a founder, like so many different vantages coming together. And then just the, you know, the cultural background and that context. And again, I'm going to just reflect back to, I saw Kavitan is now in the audience, about the white guys that were building this stuff, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And it feels like there's a sort of an energy or momentum, at least in parts of the Web3 world, where it's like, look, there are a lot of like institutions that will fail and we don't want to be beholden or reliant upon them. Like, even if the things we stand up fail, we want to at least have some agency in how they come apart. And so, you know, if I'm thinking about Syria, or I'm thinking about like Belarus, or I'm thinking about people who are all over the world, like trying to figure out and make sense, you know, where their governments are not actually working for them, where there is graft in the government itself, where there is not the rule of law as there is in the United States, or where there is a huge amount of unbanked people, these technologies, or at least the benefits of the web and web 2.0, which were, I think, well felt within the sort of, you know, Western world, United States, Europe, and so forth, needs to reach out and sort of come into the rest of the world with all of the different challenges, you know, cultural, governmental, you know, institutional. And so like the building blocks of web 3, I think, are trying to solve for some of those issues that are just not felt by people in, you know, the quote unquote, like developed world. So I think we have to start to sort of expand our frame of reference when evaluating these ideas and these technologies. Who is being enfranchised? Who is being disenfranchised? How inclusive is it? How exclusive is it? Like, how does it deal with wealth and distribution, or does it? Is it even trying to solve for that? Again, I'm not trying to like go down that path again, even though, you know, you brought it up, because I think it's so important to sort of understand or to get into, and I have no idea what Evie's values are or what her experience is, but I don't know to what degree she's also considering like that broader frame and that broader context when it comes to this question of ownership that is not dictated by conglomerates or by big tech companies, but is just determined by, you know, entries in a public ledger, you know, which is this blockchain. You know, the last thought that I'll leave you with, I guess, is I was thinking about how one of the big, okay, so I will sort of speak to what Kavitan and I were talking about, because Kavitan was asking, like, what is the Netscape moment for Web3? You know, what is the thing that's really going to like help people understand, you know, why this is so cool and interesting and to make it accessible? And he and I think, have a different, or at least, you know, in our conversation, had a different idea of, and Brian, I'm curious about your thoughts about this, like what the value of Netscape was. To me, the value of Netscape actually was that it was a read-write browser that it allowed for anybody anywhere that had an internet connection to contribute to the web. That the authorship part of Netscape was the significant aspect, not the fact that it created this consumer web that anybody could access and, you know, look up information. And so Web3, I think, comes from a similar vein. And my thought, my question, you know, and a lot of people complain about gas, but if you could write on an unerasable chalkboard in a way that the world would not be able to erase your message and everyone would be able to see it as long as they had the tools and the know-how, how much would you pay to put that message out there? And suddenly gas fees like make a lot more sense. Yes, we trivialize it and we're like, oh, you know, I'm buying these JPEGs for, you know, tens or hundreds of dollars or whatever. But that's not actually the thing that's the most interesting about it. So we're starting with something very basic, very primitive. You know, Napster started with something, you know, basic, you know, pirating music. But that was a relatable thing. So I guess that's the thought that I have about why this technology is so interesting, is if we get outside of our own perspective of what the internet is, and we think more broadly, does that change the calculus of how we're evaluating, you know, NFTs, Web3, and all of these different technologies that we're able to sort of scoff at now?
I'm not plugging my book because I'm not going to name it. But in my book, I said that what Netscape did, what the first browsers did was it wasn't just like people go in front of a computer and see a web page for the first time and are like, oh my God, I want to see more of this. It was also, they went back and made their own web pages, you know? So like that was the sort of flywheel of the early internet. Was it wasn't just that people were seeing cool things and had access to data and information they didn't have before. It was also, I'm going to go out and contribute to this. And one way to put this in a bow to bring back to how we transitioned to this, where I suggested to you the cynical take is that Web3 was an invention of VCs.
Which seems to be Jack's suggestion, perhaps.
Right. In the same way that the energy of the early web was so obvious that even though it became this big, money, land grab, money thing, the energy and excitement that someone like Randy has is not something that Chris Dixon just dreamed up as a way to have an excuse for another multi-billion-dollar fund. It really is out there. And so, you know, whether that's being channeled by big money or not is another question, but,
well, big money has also gotten a lot more savvy and they pulled the Facebook, which is to follow, you know, what people are doing, like, where's the behavior and how can we invest in what's already working? Right.
Right.
So everyone has gotten somewhat more savvy about how and where to place their bets. But I do think that folks in the Web3 crowd, like there is a kernel of something that resists that type of, you know, creation of oligarchs. I'm not saying it's resistant to it, but it feels like the fact that everything is visible and on chain, presuming you have the tools and the tools get better for inspecting the chain, that is an enabling technology that I don't think we fully understand what its ramifications will be. You know, like it's funny, as I've been doing some, I guess, you know, research trying to go back to even, you know, 5-10 years ago, there was so much link rot out there. It's so hard to find old articles, old websites that refer to apps or businesses or things that, you know, I would want people to learn from. If those things were on chain, granted, sort of our version of on chain is in the Wayback Machine, but to be able to have that stored someplace where you can't remove it does create an immutable archive of where we've been, what we've talked about, what we've learned, etc. So again, there's something in it. I'm not saying it's perfect by any means, but I think of these things as like a complexity balloon. You squeeze one end and complexity goes someplace else. But, you know, for a little while, like the balloon has sort of like reshaped itself into something new.
And it's early, so we don't have to have all the answers yet. Right. Yeah. I think we should wrap it there. I do want to, before we go, the guest we had on at the beginning, Natasha Mascarenhas from TechCrunch. She also is the co-host of the Great Equity podcast. If you want a podcast that keeps you up to date on VC and fundraising stuff, I listen to Equity every week. Also, Katie Roof covers VC startups, all that stuff for Bloomberg. Chris, I didn't write down our third guest.
Christine Hall,
and she's from TechCrunch as well.
She is, yep.
So I want to thank everyone that came on. Randy, I want to thank you for coming on as well. Chris, I'm glad you're feeling better.
Yeah, me too. And now I probably need to go nap for 3 hours.
There you go. All right, thank you, everybody.
Amazing. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.
A pleasure, as always.
As always. Thanks, Randy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Save on Cox Internet when you add Cox Mobile and get fiber-powered internet at home and unbeatable 5G reliability on the go. So whether you're playing a game at home,
yes, goal,
or attending one live,
goal,
you can do more without spending more. Learn how to save at cox.com/internet. Cox Internet is connected to the premises via coaxial cable. Cox Mobile runs on the network with unbeatable 5G reliability as measured by Ookla LLC in the U.S. 2H 2023. Results may vary, not an endorsement. Other restrictions apply.